This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Tasha Robinson, here with
Genevieve Kosky,
Scott Tobias,
Keith Phipps.
Here on the Next Picture Show, we believe that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. This week, we're going to look at a new science fiction sequel about androids and humanity and see how it stacks up to the original. But first, somebody should do something about that tortoise lying in the corner of the studio over there. Genevieve. It's thrashing around trying to turn itself over, but it can't. Not without your help. But you're not helping. Why is that, Genevieve? Why aren't you helping?
Well, for one thing, all my turtle maintenance time goes to my own pet turtle at home. But for another thing, we're trying to record here, Tasha. That tortoise is going to be fine for the next hour. So while we consider Denis Villeneuve's Blade Runner 2049 and how it takes up the story Ridley Scott's Blade Runner started back in 1982. Scott's film, a heavily rewritten adaptation of Philip K. Dick's novel Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, deals with the far future world of 2019, where artificial people called replicants have been created to work in hazardous conditions in off-world colonies. Replicants are banned on Earth, so when some of them rebel and return, android hunters called Blade Runners are dispatched to hunt them down and quote-unquote retire them. Villeneuve's sequel takes up the story 30 years later and has a police replicant called Kay doing his own Blade Runner work, retiring models that are considered obsolete. Both films question what it means to be human, but both of them also keep the philosophy submerged under action, maybe to cover up the fact that apparently all you need to be human is a few convincing stories about your mother and a snappy answer to that turtle question.
Yeah, I can certainly tell many convincing stories about my mother, which is a thing that I have, because I am definitely a human. We'll be right back after this break to talk about both Blade Runner movies, or at least I'll be back after this break. The rest of you, it may depend on your human reflexes.
I've got four skin jobs walking the streets,
They're either a benefit or a hazard. If they're a benefit, it's not my problem.
I'm Rachel.
Deckard.
Have you ever retired a human by mistake?
No.
I need the old Blade Runner. This is a bad one.
How can it not know what it is?
If only you could see what I've seen.
More human than human is our motto.
Back in 1992, when the so-called director's cut of Blade Runner was released, LA Times film critic Kenneth Turan wrote a monumental piece about the making of the film, which is apparently the kind of nightmare usually reserved for Francis Ford Coppola or Stanley Kubrick movies. The people who worked on it called it Blood Runner, Turan writes, a sardonic tribute to the amount of personal grief and broken relationships it caused, and they recall it with horror and awe. Among other things, Turan tracks how Hampton Fancher's script, adapted from Philip K. Dick's novel, spent a long time bouncing around Hollywood because producer Michael Dealey wanted Ridley Scott to direct, and Scott was busy with a little movie called Alien. The script, which kept changing names from Android to Animal to Mechanismo to Dangerous Days, went through 8 revisions before Fancher was bumped off the project, and at one point, they apparently brought in Dustin Hoffman as the lead. Scott did eventually sign on, and he promptly showed up on the first day of shooting and began redesigning the set. Turan describes the design process as an attempt to get to a point where, quote, progress and decay would exist hand in hand. Ridley Scott started his career as a production designer, which helps explain both the meticulous, elaborate design of Blade Runner and Alien and other films he's directed, and the hell that he put his designers through on this film. It may also explain why Blade Runner is so obsessed with slowly exploring these elaborate urban exteriors and the costumed people and the flashing, floating neon signs that flow through them. Blade Runner is a visual dream of a movie, but at its worst, it can also feel inert and listless, as if Scott is more interested in drifting through the world he's created than chasing the replicants around in it. There is a fair bit of action and violence in Blade Runner, especially toward the end, but the film is built more around the sullen, frustrated mood of the city than around those story beats, and Scott's obsession with a feeling of the future is a large part of that. But to some degree, that attitude also comes baked into the story. Harrison Ford stars as Rick Deckard, a kind of future bounty hunter called a Blade Runner. The story behind that title, by the way, is a long, complicated one, and it's well worth looking into. The history involves William S. Burroughs and a novelist named Alan Norse, who came up with the term for his healthcare dystopia novel, which literally has men who run black market scalpels around town. Rick Deckard considers himself retired, but he's forced back into service when a group of rogue replicants arrive on Earth, and he's ordered to hunt them down. That's part of the sullen, reluctant feel of the movie. Deckard isn't a true believer, invested in the need to kill artificial humanoids. He's a beaten-down, weather-worn character in Raymond Chandler mode, and like so many noir detectives, he spends a good part of the story getting beaten up for his efforts. And so Blade Runner doesn't feel anything like a conventional science fiction action story. It has a hero who's charged with killing sentient beings solely because they don't want to be slaves. He doesn't seem to like what he does, and he isn't necessarily all that good at it. Midway through the film, he even falls for a replicant named Rachel, played by Sean Young, as a confused woman who can't accept that she's artificial. She seems to mostly want to escape Deckard, even as he's pulling her into a relationship. And the primary villains Deckard is facing include Roy Batty and Pris, replicants played by Rutger Hauer and Daryl Hannah, who have a sort of feral Joker and Harley Quinn relationship, but sometimes just come across as desperate for the life they were denied when they were created. Replicants come with a built-in short lifespan, and Roy, Pris, and their fellow replicants are already close to dying when the movie starts. So, Blade Runner is the story of a killer who doesn't really want to kill, a femme fatale who isn't interested in seduction or manipulation, villains who don't want to be villains, and a vast, shining city that seems a lot clearer about its goals than any of the characters are. No wonder this became a cult movie that viewers have been arguing over, picking apart, and rewatching for 35 years now. We'll do a little of all of those things ourselves as we get into discussing the 1982 Blade Runner.
You remember the spider that lived in a bush outside your window? Orange body, green legs. Watched her build a web all summer. Then one day there's a big egg in it.
The egg hatched.
The egg hatched.
And?
And 100 baby spiders came out. And they ate her.
Implants. Those aren't your memories. They're somebody else's. They're Tyrell's nieces.
Okay. Bad joke. I made a bad joke. You're not a replicant. Go home. Okay?
So what do you guys think? Why is this movie such an enduring hit?
I mean, it wasn't a hit when it came out, right? I mean,
wasn't. It got kind of mediocre-ish reviews, and it did kind of okay box office.
Yeah.
But it really has endured. I mean, it's got a reputation, certainly, as a cult masterpiece.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, and maybe I'm just reflecting on my own experiences with the movie, but I felt like there was a 10-year period where people weren't talking about Blade Runner. And then with the 1992 revival, which became widespread with the release of the director's cut, I feel like that sort of like ground zero for modern Blade Runner fandom. I could be wrong. That's certainly when I latched onto it. You know, I saw this movie as a midnight movie, you know, when it was in re-release, and I thought, I've never seen anything like this before. This is the movie I'm going to be visiting a lot. And you know what? I was right. It's a movie probably on the short list of movies I've watched the most times. Mm-hmm. It's a movie I could pretty much watch at any given moment, just kind of sink into it. And for me, a lot of it just has to do with just the enveloping atmosphere of it. It's a movie I like to just kind of live in and walk around in a little bit. And I find the questions it raises really interesting, but also it's a movie where I see something different every time.
Yeah, I mean, exactly right. I mean, I think it's the look and feel of the film that is the primary reason why people keep returning to it. It's just, it's so beautiful. And I think Vangelis' score is a little underrated in terms of being part of that seductive quality of the film. So, I mean, apart from just any action on the screen, it's such a beautiful piece of art just to watch. I mean, if you think about like cinematic worlds, like great, vivid cinematic worlds, I mean, you'd have to put this among, you know, on a short list, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And it's a beauty that isn't diminished by the passing of time and advances in technology. Like, it is definitely one of those movies that still looks as amazing today as it did in 1982. And you don't have to look at it through the lens of, like, this looked amazing for the time. And there's some seams now, but no, there are no seams. Like, it's beautiful in, I know, on Blu-ray, on 4K, like, you know, whatever transfer you're watching, it's still beautiful. And I think that has helped, like, kept the myth of it alive.
Every time those opening images, that eye, and then the cityscape, just takes my breath away. And it's like, and with the music on top of it, it is just sort of this beautiful, but also foreboding and really unnerving looking cityscape. Among the openings of films, it's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I can't help but wonder if some of that is just the use of miniatures and models, mm-hmm. as opposed to flats or paintings or projections or, you know, a lot of the other methods that were used at the time. And certainly, you know, nothing digital. Everything still has a really physical feel,
mm-hmm.
and like, no matter how much you blow it up, or like how much sharper images get, it still has like that image of the sort of black pyramid with all the flying cars sort mm-hmm. of swooping around it. No matter how close you get to it, it still has a physicality to it that really says something about practical effects.
A couple of other things about the appeal of the film, too, is one, I think it's a perfect original fusion of genres of science fiction and noir just being just beautifully woven together. And I think that's part of it. And the other thing is, I think the world of the film is full of mystery, and a mystery that it doesn't really go out of its way to define, in terms of like, how did this world come to be? And what are the rules that dictate it? And how do people live? It's not really out there to answer all of those questions for you. And so you can just kind of let your mind kind of circle around that.
I do wonder, I have to wonder, how much extra textuals matter in this case. Mm-hmm. I'm throwing that word out there just in hopes of seeing Scott flinch.
They don't, but go ahead.
Well, in this case, you know, there's so much debate has been raised over, there have been 8 different versions of this film, mm-hmm. in terms of different cuts. Some of those cuts have been exceedingly minor differences, but it's been a huge arguing point for just cinema fans. Like, which one is the definitive one? Which one is the best one? Like, what does the addition of this 8 seconds mean or not mean? Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, there's the ongoing controversy over whether Harrison Ford's character, Rick Deckard, is himself a replicant. And those two things have fueled, I think, a certain science fiction fandom, the fandom of people defined often by their desire to nitpick and pull dance, things apart, yeah. and debate things endlessly and to be right. Like, this film is debated in a way that few others are. And I can't help but wonder if those arguments have kept this film at the forefront in a way that other beloved films like Ridley Scott's Alien, for instance, haven't hung on in exactly the same way, because it's not constantly being brought back in geek circles.
In terms of the versions, I feel like there are really only 2 significant versions of this film, and there's variations on those. There is the theatrical cut with the voiceover, and there's the 1992 director's cut without the voiceover and with some significant additions and a different ending. And I feel like the final cut is just sort of like fine-tuning that with a few additions, and there's other versions of the theatrical cut. And here's where I confess to never actually watching the theatrical cut all the way through. I feel like I'm a huge fan of this film, and I someday I'll sit down and do it, but I've gone back and I've watched the differences, I've watched the narration, I know everything that happens in the theatrical cut, but if I'm going to dedicate 2 hours of watching this film, I'm going to watch a version of the film I really like. And my experience of the theatrical cut is I found the voiceover intrusive. I find it sort of good information to know, and I think that probably is, you know, in terms of extra textuals, I think I can bring that information into my understanding of the later versions. But I feel like the changes made to make the director's cut, the removal of the voiceover, the addition of the unicorn, the removal of the happy ending, make it a much better film. I ride with that version and variations of that.
Yeah, I watched the theatrical version for the first time in preparation for this just because it seemed like something I should do. And while we're confessing, semi-shameful opinions, like, I don't think that the voiceover in the original is, I mean, it's kind of famously a terrible voiceover, and Ford, you can hear his reluctance in every single syllable. But I kind of like the idea of the voiceover, and like, I can imagine a world in which that voiceover is delivered in a different way where it really works.
And it's a noir.
Yeah, exactly. It fits the noir, and it does kind of, and this may be coming from the fact that I have seen this movie multiple times, but like, it does provide a little more sensory input during those beautiful, long, slow scenes where you're just like watching, you know, the beauty, and like, that's great, but it's also kind of nice to like have something else happening during those moments as well. I did kind of enjoy the voiceover in some of those moments that I have taken in and soaked in over the years, but this was like a different way to take them in that I kind of liked. The happy ending is trash, and I'm glad it's gone.
Yeah, I wonder if it was just a matter of direction, like Harrison Ford's in the booth and you just tell him, be actor Harrison Ford, not media tour Harrison Ford, and then maybe you get a better performance out of him.
Tyrell really did a job on Rachel. Right down to a snapshot of a mother she never had, a daughter she never was. Replicants weren't supposed to have feelings. Neither were Blade Runners. What the hell was happening to me?
Yeah, my experience is mostly with the director's cut as well, though I have seen the theatrical and prefer the director's. But you're right about the noir aspect being appropriate. And I think, obviously, Warner Brothers felt a little bit of information was necessary to kind of carry the audience through the movie.
I mean, there are things I did not pick up until I actually read the novel, which it's very loosely based on in some ways, but other ways very connected to. But the whole idea of animals, actual live animals being a precious commodity, is so central to the Philip K. Dick novel. And you don't necessarily get what's going on with the owl the first time around watching this movie if you don't have that narration.
I think that the movie cues you in that the owl isn't real because it keeps catching those the reflections of its pupils, which are exactly the same as what you get from the replicants. Which the thing I never understood about the Voight-Kampff test is like, why do you need all of these abstract questions when you could just look at their weird glowing eyes and see that they're artificial? I mean, it's a great effect. It's a unnerving and eerie every time it comes up. But every time it comes up, I think, why did you need all these questions? Mm-hmm. Scott, you've brought up the noir aspects a couple times now, and that was one thing that we wanted to kind of dive into. If you look at this structurally, it's a gumshoe novel with a femme fatale, and the femme fatale has a bad husband that she wants to be rid of, and she falls into a relationship with him, with the PI, even though she doesn't really care for him all that much. And then the evil husband dies. Except that it isn't constructed that way at all. Like, so many of those tropes don't actually fit those tropes. It only looks like that at the most surface level possible. So the film is playing with noir ideas, and it's certainly playing with noir tones, but it also is doing a lot of new things with them. I'm curious sort of what you guys think about the noir elements here, how they work, how they don't work.
Well, first of all, I do you think that she doesn't have an interest in Deckard?
Oh God, this is going
to
be one of
those. Do we
want
to move to this?
We can move to this because I think it's an interesting element of it as well. We're talking about the love scene or sex scene or rape, depending on how you look at it, right? To me, I think it's an unsettling scene, but I also feel like it's thematically tied into the rest of the film. We're talking about a scene in which he says, "Kiss me," and sort of pushes himself on her. And in the film about who is and who isn't human and what defines consent and what defines free will, I think this is kind of a pushing those ideas to a very uncomfortable place in a really interesting way. And I think we have to decide for ourselves what's going on, what's going through his head, what's going through her head, the question of whether or not he's a replicant or not factors into it as well. And she clearly being a replicant, what kind of free will she has and whether or not her reaction to him afterward is a result of actual choice and actual fondness for him or something else. I think it's part of the ambiguity of the film.
I didn't find it that ambiguous. I think I keep forgetting how unpleasant I find that scene. And as we're sitting down and recording this, the Harvey Weinstein thing is in full flower and we're hearing all of these other accusations coming up. And like all of this stuff is very much in the zeitgeist right now. And watching this scene where she literally tries, he kisses her, she tries to leave, he slams the door in her face, throws her against a wall and demands that she express affection for him that she clearly doesn't feel. It read as rape to me.
And she's already denied him in the movie up to this point, like when he's asked her to the bar for a drink. And
she hangs up on him.
Yeah. There's quite a bit of not taking the no in that relationship that is really uncomfortable. I see what you're saying, Keith, as far as how it does kind of raise a lot of the themes of free will that are inherent in this movie. But I don't think it engages with that aspect of it. I disagree with you there. I think like that relationship is all about Deckard and his evolution and what he thinks about replicants, and it is not at all about Rachel. She's just a catalyst in what's happening for Deckard. I don't get any sense of her connection to him beyond self-preservation, which is kind of a terrible romantic motivation. And like this is a romance. I think the heart of the movie is supposed to be this romance between them, and it isn't there for me because there is nothing coming from Rachel that I can connect to as a viewer.
So I guess my question then would be, where do you think the director is coming from in this? I don't like it to say the word intent, what is his intent, because I always have that whole thing about the fallacy of intent, but what was his intent? What was he trying to do, and did he follow it? Is this a mistake on his part?
I mean, I can't tell you whether it was a mistake or what he intended. I think there are two things going on here. One, the script went through 8 different rewrites, and then Fancher was bumped off the script, and somebody else came in and rewrote it. I kind of feel like the major scenes we see with Rachel feel like they came from different drafts. And the draft where he sexually assaults her, and by the end she goes along with it either out of fear or because she sees what she can get out of it, feels like a different thing from towards the end where she says she loves him and they go off together. But either way, for me, the whole thing fits very neatly into a noir story where she is trying to get out of a relationship she doesn't want to be in. In this case, it's not literally somebody that she's married to that she doesn't want to be married to anymore. It's literally her creator slash owner. But in the same way, she is looking for an out. And he comes along and offers it to her in the form of a relationship he sees as love. If she's doing it deliberately and manipulating him, if she makes a choice at some point during that assault to go along with it and then realizes she can use him, that would fit entirely within the greater world of noir stories, mm-hmm. which very commonly have femme fatales going through with that kind of relationship with somebody they have no affection for, yeah. no interest in, but are willing to ape it. Now, I'm with Genevieve. I don't think that the film fully plays that out. I don't think it executes it as well as it could or should. And I don't think it executes it as well as I would want it to believe that the theme is there. But if I look at it through a noir lens, I can at least stomach it.
I mean, I think you see a certain, putting it euphemistically, roughness to in film noir with regard to relationships between men and women.
That carries over
yeah. into this movie. But the other interesting thing, too, and this is something you brought up in the keynote, is just how it defies and frustrates your expectations of all of these genres. You know, I mean, if you are approaching Blade Runner as a sci-fi action film, for example, is it really satisfying at all on that level? Probably not. It has some really exciting scenes in it, but it isn't. It's not a thrill ride. This is a very moody picture that doesn't really that slips every kind of definition that you want to attach to it.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, Scott was he wanted to edge more towards a Chinatown kind of feel. Chinatown isn't a satisfying action movie either.
No,
But, you know, it's a great film.
It's solidly a detective film, though.
Yeah, that's true. One of the things that I always surprises me about this is how little detecting he actually does.
It's more of like just a very drawn-out chase film or you know, a pursuit film. And because there are the four replicants, it does give me a little bit of that, like, treasure hunt or video game mentality of, like, you got to check them off one by one, you know, or it's the different stages of the quest.
And he only finds one of them.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not that great. I mean, he's probably the best at what he does, but, you know, what he does must be very hard.
He's kind of looking for needles in a haystack.
I guess the big scene of detective work is the photo scene, enhance scene.
It becomes such a cliche, but it's so thrilling in this.
Well, thrilling is one way to describe it. I found myself getting increasingly annoyed with it this time through because it is very drawn out in the way that so much in this movie is drawn out. And I do think it's maybe the one instance in this movie where the effects or the details of the world don't really work for me in terms of the, like, going into the photo and then it becoming three-dimensional. And I don't think it's presented on screen in a way that, like, makes it very clear what this technology is and what it does and how he's utilizing it. And it just comes across like enhance, enhance until I get to the thing that I need to see. But
until you get to the thing you need to see, it feels like blow up, right? like when you're just like you're zooming in and zooming in and zooming in, and it's like, what are you seeing? Can you really say what that thing is? And then, of course, you know, you're actually able to enhance and get information from it.
I mean, it doesn't 100% work for me, especially since no matter how many times I watch it, I find myself thinking, what is he looking for? What are we seeing? Why is this important? Mm-hmm. But it does lead to, A, his one moment of inspired detective work, and B, that moment where he walks into her dressing room doing that voice, his nerd voice, which is one of the best acting moments in the movie. I can never believe that voice is coming out of Harrison Ford. It's great. And like watching that whole scene build and come apart is one of my favorite unheralded moments in the movie. There are a lot of moments in this movie that are justly famous and quotable and memorable. I'm not sure that Harrison Ford's like, hey, I'm a geek who's trying to break into your dressing room under false pretenses. I'm looking for holes. Like, that whole business is so good.
He drops the voice very briefly, though, during it, doesn't he?
I mean, it's clearly not Rick Deckard's forte.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. And also, it's another detail that raises the question, is he good at his job?
I mean, he's pretty handy with a blaster.
I guess everyone else is just really bad at blade running.
Well, I mean, the society is not all that functional.
Yeah,
that's true.
A lot of people are not good at their jobs.
Yeah, this is an interesting future. You know, it's in many ways, it's a very sleek future. Like, the flying cars look super functional. And everything is very black and shiny. And you've got, like, the giant video screens everywhere.
It's very monolithic.
But at the same time, when you get close up on technology, it's kind of got that Brazil janky-ass kludged together feeling to it. So there's kind of a and you've got a technology that can send people into space and send sea beams glittering through the Tannhauser Gate, but that also, like, can't come up with a scanner that doesn't look like eight different computers piled on each other.
I think the good tech is elsewhere. I think the people who could have gotten off Earth. I mean, there's a few people like Tyrell who I think kind of are making the best of what's still around. But I get the feeling, you know, a lot of people have new life awaits them on the off-world colonies and are taking up on that because Earth's not in great shape. So I think you get the sense of this rundown world that's like, it's sort of like the center of the empire that's also become sort of the outskirts of the empire in some ways.
I find it fascinating with science fiction worlds. Like, Star Wars gets a lot of praise for being a beat-up world where everything looks used. And Star Trek gets a lot of praise for being this, like, shiny, futuristic world that people would want to live in. I find it so much more interesting when science fiction worlds do both, when they acknowledge that in the future, as now, there will probably be a disparity of income and disparity of resources and the different levels of technology.
And also things that we believe, advances that we believe are going to make our lives better that aren't. I mean, what are replicants but that, right? Of this extraordinary feat of technology and engineering that is now coming back to kill us. We're not in control of our own creations. We're also this the world we imagine for ourselves, this better world we imagine for ourselves is not necessarily better than where we were before.
This is one of the few science fiction movies I can think of where our artificial intelligences are coming to kill us and we kind of deserve it. And we don't deserve it for playing God, which is the usual excuse for movies like Transcendence or Splice or Morgan or Ex Machina or whatever. It is the feeling of like you crossed a line that shouldn't be crossed. You scienced where you shouldn't have scienced. So, you know,
tampered in God's domain.
Exactly. This movie doesn't get into that, I don't think. It comes up to the idea of if you create sentient life and you make it your slave, then you might deserve what you get.
Yeah, beyond trying to kill us, it's sort of prompting an existential crisis about what humanity is. I mean, that's sort of the central theme of the film. And it doesn't really beat you over the head with this, but, you know, watching again, I mean, who's the most soulful character in the film? It's Roy Batty. I mean, Roy is this sort of like a ruthless killing machine in some ways, but he's also this the most reflective, the most introspective, the most philosophical character in the entire film, and he's a replicant.
And he also knows when to clench a dove in his hand for yes. effect.
I think kind of in talking about this, we also need to talk about the character of J.F. Sebastian and his friends.
He might be the most soulful character
I was debating which you were going to name, Roy Batty or J.F. Sebastian. Yeah. Which I think, just to quickly go back to something else we noted about the social disparity in this future world and like J.F. Sebastian just kind of living in this creepy old abandoned complex because he can't go off world because he has this disease. So I think he's like an interesting reflection of that aspect of this world. But to go back to what we were talking about artificial intelligence, like he's creating these horrible, these terrifying creatures, as his friends. And like the replicants are kind of like the shiny apex of that instinct, you know, and something that is so close to humanity. And what J.F. Sebastian is making is not that. And it's upsetting. And you can understand the impulse, you know, that is behind it. But it's not a good thing that he's doing.
You just don't like creepy clowns.
I don't like creepy clowns, but I don't like a lot of creepy wind-up toy creatures with ball gags in their mouths.
they seem benign.
Yeah,
they seem benign, but I don't... Yeah.
I'm sort of charmed by them, actually.
Yeah, they're a little eerie, but I think they're sweet.
Yeah.
Do you think they're happy, though?
I'm not sure how
do they enjoy their lives?
I'm not sure how intelligent or functional they are. Apart from the clown and the teddy bear, they may not be sophisticated enough to actually be intelligent. And I think
example of the film like making you question like where the line is.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think one of the things that's creepiest is when Pris positions herself among mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. There's that feeling of like all of these essentially like maybe weird looking, maybe unsettling looking, but essentially like gentle toys. And then there's a killer in their midst that looks exactly like them. That's creepy. And I think it's really well done.
Really well done. All that stuff. That's my favorite section of the movie. Anything involving him and his...
William Sanderson is probably my favorite performance in the movie.
He's great.
And it's also an example of the film being maybe a little more whimsical and entertaining and wonder, you know, it's just there's something kind of pleasurable purely about those scenes that isn't necessarily how you describe the rest of the movie around it.
Yeah, that sequence where he's just sort of hanging out with Pris and his toys in particular feels more like something out of AI than mm-hmm. anything else in this movie.
And Pris does get to mm-hmm. play the film vitale role in this in a way that...
That's true, except she's kind of shilling for her dark husband sure. as opposed to trying to escape him.
Yeah.
But yeah, she does. The whole business around William Sanderson, I think, is interesting because everybody in this film is so compromised. You know, Deckard is a killer, and the killers are manipulating people and using them and murdering them. And Tyrell himself is like hiding in his ivory tower away from the chaos he's helped create. Everybody in this film is some kind of like user or vampire or bully, except Sebastian. He's just kind of an overgrown kid sitting sadly with his toys. And I think one of the reasons that we like him is he's the only person in the movie that isn't vile in some way.
I mean, he might be compromised just by his association with Tyrell. I mean, he certainly mm-hmm. enabled Tyrell and helped create the situation that the film finds itself in.
Is his the only act of kindness in the film, of bringing her into his home? Does anyone do anything kind in the film besides that?
Off the top of my head, not that I can think of.
I mean, there's fires almost his character, letting him off the hook at the end.
Yeah, but nothing that character does can be called kind. That's a fundamentally unkind character.
I mean, one of the things that sort of baffles me most about the movie is Zora's character. Like, she doesn't necessarily do anything kind, but she just comes across as a working girl. She's got a job. Is she just out there, like, making money so the rest of the replicants can function? Why isn't she with them on their quest for more life? Is she just, like, getting by day to day, working 9 to 5?
I had the feeling they were all working together and just had different aspects of the job. I mean, I think it's a little underexplained, but I think she's certainly connected to all of them still.
So, I mean, she certainly doesn't come across as kind, but she doesn't come across as malevolent either.
Yeah, but we're, like, in the little introduction that we're given to them at the beginning, isn't she described as, like, a fundamentally, like, violent or dangerous person?
Like, she's like a political assassin.
Yeah. So, like, we're told that she's dangerous. We don't really ever see that in the story of the film. She's
puts on a bikini and some saran wrap in order to run
and falls through several panes of glass
and high heels, because let me tell you, when I know I'm about to be running for my life, first thing I do is put on the stilettos.
I mean, replicants can run in heels.
That's what my husband said. Program. What she's programmed to, like, of course she,
and it's another weapon if she needs it.
I think one of the things that for me just comes out of rewatching Blade Runner is a sense that some of these set pieces are incredibly remarkable, but to some degree that just don't all fit together. Deckard's whole, like, I am an actual gumshoe, I'm going to examine the evidence and it's going to lead me to a trail of clues and then I'm going to find my first target, doesn't necessarily fit with the rest of the movie and his actions in the rest of the movie. Roy Batty, like, going back and forth between this sort of gentle philosopher and, like, a drooling madman screaming doggerel on the roof, doesn't necessarily fit together for me. Rachel kind of has her, like, before and after periods that don't entirely fit together for me. Am I wrong in thinking that this movie feels not confused because it's so of a tone and of a piece, but feels like a lot of strange puzzle pieces welded together?
I can see having that impression. Yeah. It's never felt that disjointed to me. But I mean, I feel like we're dealing with characters who are, by their character or programming, not necessarily going to be consistent from moment to moment in some ways. These replicants are living through life and sped up, you know, 1.5 speed or faster than that. So I think they're going to go through changes in attitudes and philosophies a lot faster than regular humans would. So I think you see Batty go through sort of angry Avenger to philosophical madman by the end. I mean it's almost like Hamlet, like, by the end, where he's just sort of addressing the fundamental questions of existence as he's dying. I mean, that's all that works for me.
Batty does work for me because, as you say, he's dying. Like, he realizes he's in the last moments of his life, and I think he can be forgiven for being a little inconsistent in his emotions and at a time like that.
Well, I think also with Deckard, I like that the question remains unanswered as to whether or not he's a replicant. But I think in many ways the film makes a lot more sense if he is, just because, you know, you see this man who thinks he has a past, he doesn't. I mean, one of the clues that people point to is that he is a replicant is that his place is covered in photographs, and it's something that the replicants latch on to. And if you see someone who's just been, against his knowledge, you know, created to destroy his own kind, this is someone who's going to have a profound identity crisis, if not on a conscious level, on a subconscious level. His programming is just going to break down. And I think that is, to me, I think that's sort of the best read on his character.
I
would never actually say the film definitively says he's a replicant.
But it's a relevant question, you think, that it be answered? Is it important that it be answered?
I don't know if it's important that it be answered, but I think Keith just demonstrated why it's a relevant question character. Yeah,
I guess so.
I think it's better if it's left unanswered.
It is that. It's funny to
that hasn't stopped.
That the new one just answers it immediately, at least with regard to Ryan Gosling's character.
Although it still doesn't answer it about Harrison Ford's character.
We'll get into it in second.
Well,
second half.
One thing I will say about this movie, though, and I don't know if it has to do with it being disjointed or in any way, but, like, I just saw it twice with Keith. I saw it once on the big screen in digital projection, and then I saw it at his home on his 4K television, which was very nice.
Congratulations,
and
Keith.
It's so...
It's really nice.
And I will say the film is a fundamentally elusive experience for me. Mm-hmm. It's very hard for me, even now, after seeing this extraordinarily vivid film twice in short succession, to have really strong opinions or recall or super cogent take as I would on virtually any other type of film that I would see, have seen that often, and it's so recently, I guess. And so, and I don't know if I consider that a flaw of the film rather than just the reality of it. It is like tears in the in the rain.
Snow.
Well, I think that's part of the. I think that's what draws me back is mm-hmm. that it is elusive and it is unanswered. And like, you know, you say disjointed, I say
dreamlike.
I say dreamlike. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
It is pretty dreamlike. Here's the thing. I have an emotional reaction to this film and an intellectual one. And the intellectual one says, there are a lot of interesting pieces here that don't add up. And the emotional one just reacts to the music, to the mm-hmm. tone, to the performances, which we haven't talked about much apart from Sanderson's. The performances lure me in to this film over and over and over. And I'm very positive on this movie. I find myself examining my positivity and wondering to some degree where it comes from, because the intellectual side of my brain keeps trying to latch onto some story thread in this thing that makes sense, some character development that makes sense, and a lot of it doesn't. But it's a wonderful film. It's a wonderful feeling and looking film, and always has been.
Well, I think we should also talk about the period in which it emerged in some ways and Scott's career. I mean, Scott started in commercials where Arresting Images triumphs all, and it appeared alongside sort of like the high point of the early days of music videos where it's, you don't see the fast cutting, but you definitely see like sort of, you know, translations of postmodernism, sort of screens within screens and brands, you know, sort of the corporate culture, like foregrounded in some really interesting ways. It's definitely, it's to me, it's kind of the triumph of that moment in many ways.
At the same time, this was his first film after Alien, and Alien is in many ways a conventional start to finish story. I mean, it was establishing a template that had not fully been established yet. And he did, we talked about it at great length on a previous podcast. He did amazing things with this kind of story, and particularly the look of it, the imagistic, visually driven look of it. But at the same time, there is a monster. There are a bunch of people fighting the monster. In the end, one of them survives the monster. That is a pretty conventional story. Blade Runner is so unconventional mm-hmm. by comparison.
Tasha, you were talking about your intellectual response to it, and I guess your emotional response to it. Mm-hmm. And it's my just general aesthetic opinion that the characters and story, that intellectual component, it should be minimized. My interest as a film goer is in the other side of that, is in how the tools of the medium are used to express something. And a lot of that in this film is done through the world of the film and how it's established and how it's photographed and how the music works and the effects and just the feel of the film is crucial to me, to the point where all these other aspects are not as important. That's just me and my own way of looking at things. So I sort of cherish Blade Runner for those reasons. But if you think about, like, say, Harrison Ford's performance in the movie, I don't think it's one of his more interesting or compelling performances. I don't connect to it terribly strongly. And I think removing that voiceover from the director's cut almost properly lessens his presence in the film.
It decentralizes him.
Yeah. Yeah.
It makes him much less the kind of defining part of the film. I think that his performance here is really interesting, because we think of Harrison Ford, we think of these smirking hip shot characters, and people forget how goofy Han Solo was. Like, you can see supercuts on the internet of Han Solo being lost, confused, hurt, scared, wigged out, incompetent. But people don't remember him that way. People remember him, slouched in the cantina shooting Greedo first. People remember him as the guy with the snappy comeback. People remember Indiana Jones, the guy with the whip. People remember him as the president punching people out on his plane. Like, Harrison Ford's characters just have this sort of you know, rep for being in control, smirking, and like always knowing what they're doing. He spends most of this movie looking terrified out of his gourd, and like he spends the entire final act crawling backwards across a rainy rooftop, desperately trying to get away from something, running away from it, going out a window to get away from it. He spends so much of this movie scared. I find it fascinating. I find it a fascinating choice. I think that the movie is not 100% sold on him as the hero, even as the protagonist, and as we've said several times, not necessarily good at his job. And that makes him a really compelling character for me, in part because Ford just kind of goes for broke with it. Like, this is not a very ego-filled performance.
And not necessarily good. I mean, that's part of why I'm less unnerved by the sexual assault thing. It's like, I'm not sure Deckard's a good guy. You know, I think, again, I think it taps into the central question of the film. It's like, this is someone who sees this person as less than human and should just be able to bend to his will because of that. And you know, there's sort of an evolution of that over the course of the film where he kind of comes to a greater understanding of who replicants are. But I don't think he's a morally, you know, totally good character.
I think we're conditioned to believe that Harrison Ford, being Harrison Ford and being the hero of this film, is the hero. But you know, the more you watch it, the more you think, hey, Rutger Hauer and Daryl Hannah, I see where you're coming from in this, and it's kind of reversing my presumptions about who's a hero and who's a villain in this thing.
Yeah, I think this movie reverses a lot of presumptions, and I think that's one of the things that makes it so interesting. So I think it's going to be interesting to take it up in conjunction with Blade Runner 2049, which also does some unconventional things, also does some very conventional things, and I think kind of takes up some of the themes that are underlined at play here and makes them more overt. We'll get into that in more detail in part two. In the meantime, we're going to move on to feedback, so we'll be right back. As usual, because of the way we've been recording early to get around film festival season, we're running a few episodes behind on feedback. Although, frankly, we're surprised we're not hearing more ranting about Mother from you guys. Would love to hear your thoughts on that film, or maybe, given some of the things our old buddy and sister podcast host Matt Singer has posted about people's theatrical experiences after Mother, maybe we just want to hear how berserk the audiences got in your screenings. For now, though, here are some of the letters we received about our pairing of Stand By Me and It. Keith, you are up first.
Sam writes, I loved your examination of It. Thanks, Sam. Oh, all of our exam, not just mine. Okay. I loved your examination of It, and I agree with every conclusion that you reached, except one thing that I had a different read on. I had a very different reaction to Stan's Modigliani fear than Tasha. Where Tasha suggested it was a superficial odd one out, to me it was a highlight in the film's portrayal of fear. While a viewer might be better able to understand Mike being haunted by his parents' death or Eddie's hypochondria, Stan's fear of a scary picture felt very much more representative of how children create fear for themselves. Growing up, my grandfather had a painting from a theatrical production of Harvey that he directed hanging in his basement. It was a life-size portrait of himself posing with a 6-foot-tall, doll-eyed rabbit in the painterly style of John Singer's Sargent.
Yeah.
I'm dying to see this. Please send pictures. Fear of this painting kept me out of the basement for years and absolutely ruined Donnie Darko for me. The image itself is innocuous, but still sends shivers down my spine. This may still have been a shortcut to give Stan a fear without having to invest time into building him into an actual character, but it was still revelatory to see such a specific fear from my own childhood realized on screen. And for a movie about the power of fear, that was a very welcome detail. I'll add to this. It's the one detail I know Stephen King has singled out as being a great part of the film. So you're not alone.
Is it the director of Maximum Overdrive?
Yeah. Yeah, it's good to know that Stephen King thinks that this was a good part of the film, because now I can loathe it unreservedly. I love Stephen King as a writer. He's not necessarily the most trustworthy film critic. I actually do agree that this is very representative of how kids create fears out of something weird and random they see that comes across as uncanny. And that description, Sam, of the painting in your basement sounds horrifying and nightmarish. And
again,
I agree.
Please send pictures.
Yes, absolutely. But again, for me, I think it was just a feeling that piled on top of everybody else's nightmares. It was just too much.
Exactly, right? I mean, how many nightmares had we seen until we get to that point, right? So we already have that to deal with. And then it's an example of just the CGI run amok. I think maybe the very specific nature of the sequence itself, the way it's pulled off, is maybe more objectionable than the conceit.
I think that after seeing Ben being chased by like that headless, herky-jerky smoking man, I think anything would have been less scary for me. I honestly think that if this was a story about a kid haunted by a painting, if it was about Stan and Stan's experience, the painting and the distortion of it, the creepy visual of it. Well, I mean, the same director did the same thing in Mama, who also has that weird, elongated, unnatural face. And she's horrifyingly creepy. So I think that in isolation, Stan's nightmare makes a lot more sense to me. But just piled up with everything the other kids are facing, it just seemed like both too much and not enough because it wasn't personal to him.
America disagrees.
And so does Stephen King. Here's a longer letter that looks at the character of Beverly Marsh in it and asks, did she really have to be drawn in such a lazy way? Scott, you want to read this one?
Yes. Kevin writes, you touched on its damsel in distress treatment of Beverly a little in the podcast, but I think the film's lazy treatment of Beverly is much more extensive. It's like the filmmakers thought that since they were making an 80s nostalgia piece, they had to include the casual sexism of 80s popular culture. Beverly's fears are entwined with her sexuality and her fear of being sexualized. The big reason she doesn't fit in is that people have spread rumors that she's quote-unquote easy. The buckets of blood spraying from her sink are obviously connected with the onset of her period, and in the real world, her father is clearly making a terrifying sexual threat to her. That all makes sense and fits in with the movie's use of childhood fears taking literal form through the torments of Pennywise slash It. But the movie itself only, or at least mostly, seems to see Beverly in terms of her sexuality. There are multiple scenes of the boys ogling her in her underwear, which, okay, a group of boys possibly seeing a live girl in her underwear for the first time are quite possibly going to have a reaction similar to that in the movie. But then we get another scene of them ogling her while she sunbathes, with Richie making a joke about whether she's going to take her clothes off. Later, she casually flirts with the old pharmacist, who flirts back, and it's all played as a joke. Haha, here's a grown man in a position of trust flirting with a 12-year-old. And while we're supposed to find him creepy, we're also supposed to think it's funny, which really does not fit with Beverly's apparently deep-seated fear of her own sexuality. Finally, Beverly being kidnapped is the inciting incident to have the boys go into the sewer to confront Pennywise. That, as you said in the podcast, is just lazy. But to make things so much worse, the way they revive Beverly when they find her is Ben kisses her. For a sweet, beautiful beat, I really thought the kiss wasn't going to work, and they were going to have to find a non-sleeping beauty method for waking Beverly up, but no. Of course that's how you wake someone up who's in some sort of demon-caused floating coma. It's also disappointing to me. In Beverly's first interaction with Ben, she's confident and funny and smart. She's also positioned as braver than the boy sometimes. She's the first to jump off the cliff. She's the first to realize Pennywise feeds on fear. But for me, those things are outweighed by a series of lazy decisions that detract from what could have been a much better character. At least she got to have a character, unlike Mike.
There is a lot to unpack here. I'm going to start with Beverly's fear of her sexuality. It is fairly common in abuse victims for them to act out sexually, for them to find ways to try to own their own sexuality. And I thought the movie was actually pretty smart about that. I don't think that it's ogling Beverly. I think that it's having her act out in ways that she's not allowed to act out around the home. And that it's a coming of age thing. She is trying to own her own body and control how her body is put in the world. And the boys around her, I think their reaction is appropriate. They try to be cool about it, but they're also kind of getting their minds blown. I didn't mind that aspect of the film at all, because I think it's very in keeping with how people act when they're being controlled in this fashion.
Really, to me, I thought it was a pretty interesting portrayal of female adolescence until the ending, which I thought was the whole damsel in distress thing was kind of undermined a lot of the things that preceded it. But I thought watching the film, I thought it did a pretty interesting job of teasing out some subtleties of what it means to be a girl on the verge of adolescence and suddenly you realize you're recognized as a sexual object by those around you, even people for whom it's really inappropriate to be a sexual object, and you know you want to be seen as thing. Other than that, and then you kind of have to deal with the fact that there's probably no avoiding that, even with, you know, with your friends. I don't know. I thought that all of that was fairly interesting and nuanced. And then again, it's kind of throw all that out the window with the damsel in distress stuff at the end.
I still haven't seen it and probably won't anytime soon. But I did edit a piece for Vox on this subject and on Beverly's sexuality and how the film handles it. So I did want to mention it because I thought it was really fascinating, even having not seen the film. But it's by my colleague Asia Romano, and it's specifically talking about one scene, which is the bathroom cleanup scene. Basically, her argument is it, like so many of Stephen King's story, is at some level a story about boys becoming men. And that is like an ongoing fixation of his. And she is positioned within that story about boys becoming men. So in the context of that reading, the boys helping her clean up after this traumatic blood spurting scene is saying something about supporting women and believing them when they go through traumatic experiences and helping them. And that is positioned as a moment of growing up and of maturity. And like I said, I still haven't seen it. So I'm just, you know, going off of this piece, but I really liked that reading of it.
I do too. That's a good
idea. Yeah, really absolutely. Yeah.
And kind of demystifying blood and you know, female body experiences in a way that you have to get past if you're not going to be a 12-year-old boy your entire life.
Yeah, I mean, her relationship with being part of this group is important to her and is helpful to her. I don't really agree with the points in this letter at all except the last one about the damsel in distress business. This is the most resonant character in the movie for me. It's the fear in the film that registers most sharply, and I thought it was treated just fine.
Yeah, I think that she is not afraid of her sexuality. She is afraid of what her father may do to her because of her sexuality, and that is a very different thing. That said, I mean, I said it at the time, we've said it before, you say it, I'll say it again, the whole damsel in distress thing is lazy and boring, and just a particularly egregious choice since it's such a big change from the book. And I felt the same way about the kissing thing as you did. But I guess I let that one go because it's so obviously a, like, how do we respect the fact that Stephen King has a giant child orgy in his book without doing any of it? So I kind of felt like I took that one with a grain of salt just because it, like, they're sort of nodding at it in the most squeamish way possible.
It was kind of like, that could have gone worse.
Yeah, exactly. Well, okay, where are we going to take this? Oh, nowhere. All right, thank God. Finally, a listener named Blake wrote in to let us know that when we read his letter about It Comes at Night several episodes ago, we misidentified him as Quentin. Sorry, Blake. We did not mean to do that. We did get a letter in the same movie from a listener named Quentin, and we're guessing it was a cut and paste error in the script.
To be fair, those are both super cool names.
Quentin, they are. And Blake are. And just so similar. They sound so much alike. As always, we appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and the recommendations, and in future, we will try to appreciate it so much that we consistently get your names right. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nookspictureshow.net. We may feature your response on a future episode or post it on Facebook for discussion. That wraps up this episode of The Next Picture Show. In part two, we'll jump 30 years into the future of the future and see how Villeneuve's version of Blade Runner mixes and matches with the one Hampton Fancher took from Philip K. Dick. And we absolutely promise we will not in any way provide the definitive ruling on whether Deckard is a replicant. Look for that later this week, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on Apple Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice. Find us at nextpictureshow.net, follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow, and follow us on Twitter at nextpicturepod so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, we'll be scouring YouTube for footage of attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. Somebody has to have had their Facebook Live on while that was happening, right? We'll see you next time.
All those moments will be lost in time. Like tears in rain. Time to die.